Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
A large portion of it needs to be focused on global warming and the effects that it's having on places like Nutak.
What local leaders want to see from the federal government's Arctic strategy. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 13th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a visit to U.S. House campaign headquarters in Anchorage.
I have an ironing board. I do iron my own shirts if I need to. And a pillow.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The federal government rolled out a new Arctic strategy this month, a move welcomed by Alaska's congressional delegation. But as Emily Schwing reports for KYUK, it's unclear what this new strategy means for residents on the ground back in Alaska.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the new strategy for the government's future policy in a video posted to Twitter.
More than 50,000 Americans live in the Arctic, home to unique ecosystems and biodiversity.
He outlined 4 pillars that will guide White House policy in the Arctic in coming years.
First, we'll work toward a secure Arctic region. We have no higher priority than defending our country and our people, and security in the Arctic is key to that.
The last time the U.S. government released an Arctic strategy was back in 2013. That version was heavy on military presence in the region. The new strategy also calls for improved military capabilities in Alaska, but it includes 3 other objectives that focus on economic development, climate change, and international relations and diplomacy.
It's much more of a list of goals.
That's Amy Lovecraft. She's the director of the Center for Arctic Policy at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She says the new strategy isn't necessarily new. She says the Biden administration has revived Obama-era policies that were discarded by the Trump administration.
So it's got a lot of our buzzwords, conserve and protect, you know, Arctic ecosystems, indigenous, co-production, co-management, right? What do all those things mean? And so here, right, it seems like it's pretty specific. And so in that sense, there are initiatives mentioned.
Lovecraft says the document falls short of providing clarity on how the goals outlined might be met.
So these are strategic objectives. What I want next are the action items.
It's action items that Lyman Hoffman also wants to see. He's been a state legislator representing the Bethel region as a Democrat for more than 3 decades.
How do you make people that are living in the Arctic, their lives affordable to live up here? The food is high, the transportation costs are high, the heating costs are high, everything is too exorbitant.
Hoffman says he'd like to see a strategy that addresses on-the-ground realities for Alaskans.
A large portion of it needs to be focused on global warming and the effects that it's having on places like Nutak and places that are eroding, the permafrost melting away. What effect does it have on our food supply for salmon?
Amy Lovecraft believes the timing of the new strategy's release is not coincidental. Federal midterm elections are less than a month away. The announcement also comes as Arctic leaders and policy experts gather for an annual meeting in Iceland to discuss science, innovation, and international policy in the Arctic. In Bethel, I'm Emily Schwing.
More than $100 million in grants have been announced by the federal government as part of a major effort to close the digital divide in parts of rural Alaska. The existing system includes a series of microwave transmitters with limited data transmission and vulnerability to bad weather. The grants include $73 million for a partnership between the Alaska Native Village Corporation for Bethel and telecommunications company GCI. Funding from last year's federal infrastructure bill and other sources have been lauded by political leaders and officials with Alaska Native organizations and telecommunications companies. Well, we usually measure political campaigns by the money they raise and the messages they put out, not to mention the strength of the candidate. We thought up another measure, though. What do their campaign headquarters look like? Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin visited the three main U.S. House campaigns in Anchorage and has this story.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
First stop, Mary Peltola's campaign headquarters. It's in a strip mall on Spinard Road. Behind the front desk is a campaign banner with Peltola's face on it. Organizing director Renee Martin is one of the few people in the office.
On a day with blue skies, this is actually very good news because it means everyone is out knocking doors.
This is a huge limitation of judging a campaign by its headquarters. So much of the work doesn't take place here. But it does seem that some of the energy and some of the campaign character comes through, so we're here to check on the vibe. The Peltola campaign didn't have its own offices until after she found out she'd won the special election. Martin says the organization has been growing rapidly. He's an experienced campaign hand from Cleveland, one of several non-Alaskans working here. He lets me pass the counter into a large room.
And how would you describe the decor here at your office?
Oh, boy. Campaign casual.
So we got a hodgepodge of non-matching chairs. We've got a few random desks. We have what appears to be a large dog toy on the floor.
Yeah, our campaign mascot is Rainy.
The dog, though, like most everyone else, is out.
Hello. Good morning.
Wow, a greeting committee.
From campaign casual to modern and matching, the Nick Begich campaign headquarters in a strip mall on Northern Lights. On my first attempt to visit, the door was locked. I called to make an appointment, and the next morning, Nick Begich was waiting for me.
Yeah, it's spacious. It's a very spacious
It's office. More than spacious. It's the most put together of any campaign office I've seen. The walls have a designer color scheme. Even the cubicle dividers look cool. Begich says he just rented it like this. A previous tenant sold office furniture.
Turnkey. It was a turnkey space.
A small team sits around a conference table, quietly putting rubber bands on campaign leaflets.
And then this is my space.
His office upstairs is Zoom ready. Out of camera range are more personal items.
I have an ironing board. I do iron my own shirts if I need to. And a pillow. Because I work sometimes 16-hour days, and sometimes I'll just have to crash for about 30 minutes.
Begich has been campaigning for the seat for about a year. He worked out of his house for months, and now here.
And I go full-time on this like it's a startup.
Startup. That's the vibe here. Tech startup. Sarah Palin's campaign office is in South Anchorage, a flat-roofed blue building on the old Seward Highway. It's in the real estate office of Jerry and Margaret Ward.
Hi. How are you doing?
Margaret Ward is sitting at a little table by the window. She's a campaign volunteer. We barely get to chatting when her husband arrives.
Oh, here's Jerry.
How are you doing?
Palin's senior advisor, Jerry Ward, just met with six volunteers door knocking nearby. He's a former Republican state senator, and he ran Donald Trump's campaign in Alaska.
Would one of you describe the room for me?
Well, the room is probably about 1,000 square feet. You know, we got signs and bumper stickers and things like that. This is called decorations.
There's tinsel and cray paper streamers wrapped around a post.
My grandkids did this, and this is beautiful, red, white, and blue. And there's a balloon over there, too.
One balloon.
Yes, one balloon. Yes.
We go back to the little table by the window, and the Wards tell me about their grandchildren. In the center of the table is a Bible.
What has happened, and the reason I brought it from home, is people will come in and quote the Bible to me. And I have to look it up. I don't know it by heart. I mean, I really don't.
Who comes in quoting Bible verses at you?
Different people have done it.
This headquarters, for all its Palin signs, is really a reflection of the wards. But it does share elements that Palin projects. It's homey, personality-driven, and has Trump's seal of approval. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, honoring the history of Filipino cannery workers in Juneau.
We didn't feel like we had to get in touch between seasons because we were going to go the next season and catch up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
A Fairbanks man died while hunting in the Sitka area. An Alaska State Trooper dispatch says 47-year-old Ryan Roosh was reported missing near Lake Diana, southeast of Sitka, on Tuesday morning. It says Roosh and his hunting partner became separated Monday, and Roosh did not make it back to camp by nightfall. Alaska wildlife troopers contacted the U.S. Coast Guard in Juneau for assistance searching the steep, remote area. A Coast Guard helicopter team located Roosh below a 300-foot cliff and flew him to Sitka, where paramedics pronounced him dead. Next of kin have been notified. Hundreds of hotel rooms and emergency shelter beds in Anchorage will continue to be available to people without homes through at least the end of the year. That's after the Anchorage Assembly on Tuesday committed $3.5 million more for ongoing shelter, meal, and navigation services through December 31st. The Assembly also decided that the city-owned former Golden Lion Hotel in the Tudor area will not be part of the emergency response this winter. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
The Anchorage Assembly struck the Golden Lion from its emergency cold weather sheltering plan adopted last month. However, most Assembly members do want to use the Golden Lion's 85 rooms in the city's non-emergency homelessness response. Here's Assembly Member Meg Zalatel.
I do not want to see the Golden Lion used as a shelter. I've never proposed that it be used as a shelter. But it does make sense as housing. Housing is the solution to homelessness.
Zalatel argued that it's cheaper and more stable to essentially pay the rent for someone in a city-owned asset than to pay for a bed in a less stable emergency shelter setting. She said the savings could pay for services that prevent homelessness. In an interview, Assemblymember Jamie Allard said the distinction between using it as an emergency shelter and housing for the homeless isn't meaningful to her, since it would be serving the same population. Allard was the only Assemblymember to vote against the Golden Lion change. But the distinction may resolve legal issues related to city land use codes and a past Assembly commitment not to use the Golden Lion as an emergency shelter. There was a lot of political finger-pointing during public testimony and Assembly discussion on Tuesday about who did what that led to the repeated displacement and relocation of the city's homeless residents this year. The mayor's chief of staff, Adam Trombley, told the Assembly he isn't interested in that.
I'll be honest with you, I really don't feel like getting in the middle of a political fight. I have no desire to relitigate the past. It doesn't change anything. My goal is to get along and find solutions.
Trombley said one of the next steps for the Golden Lion to become housing is for the Assembly and administration to agree on a legal land use designation. The city's homelessness response beyond 2022 is expected to be handled through the Assembly and Administration's annual budgeting process, which is underway now. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Two boats sank after they were consumed by fire at Ketchikan's Bar Harbor early this morning. Two firefighters sustained minor injuries battling the blaze. In a statement, Fire Marshal Gretchen O'Sullivan says the incident was first reported just after 2:30 a.m. Firefighters arrived to find two boats engulfed in flames. The cause of the fire is officially undetermined, but O'Sullivan says investigators believe it might be related to an alcohol stove aboard the sailboat where the fire started. Harbormaster Dan Berg says the owner of the 30-foot boat had just left when the fire broke out. Not long afterwards, the whole boat was in flames.
Fiberglass burns really hot, and it burned through a couple of his tie-up lines, allowing the sailboat to drift over next to the boat he shares a spot with, which was a 28-foot Kingfisher aluminum boat. And that one burnt completely as well.
The flames scorched the sail and canvas work of another sailboat, which sustained only minor damage. Crews placed containment booms around the sunken vessels to prevent leaking fuel from polluting the harbor. Berg says the owners plan to raise and remove the boats in the coming days. He thanked the Ketchikan Fire Department for its quick and effective response. He says it's a good idea for boat owners to keep an eye on their vessels as fall turns to winter.
This is the time of year where things like this happen, where people have heaters and heat lamps going in their boat, so they should make sure to check all their all of that kind of stuff, and also check their batteries and bilge pumps.
Two firefighters suffered smoke inhalation. One was treated and released at Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center's emergency room. The other declined treatment. Nearly two dozen firefighters responded to the harbor fire with 10 trucks from all three of Ketchikan's fire departments. Well, the village of Tuntutuliak doesn't have running water or fire hydrants. After a house burned down on Tuesday, some residents say the community needs more firefighting equipment. KYUK's Nina Kravinsky reports.
Carl Andrew manages Tuntutuliak's power plant. He was checking his blackfish trap when he saw the smoke. He took off his waders and ran toward it.
Looking at it, it's a total loss.
Carl says the first thing he did after he got there was to run to the power plant to turn off power for the whole community. The fire was starting to burn through the rubber on a power line above the home. Carl says they were able to safely take down that line. No one was injured in the fire. 74-year-old Henry Loopy was at home with his daughter when they saw the smoke. They hurried to the burning building with a 5-gallon bucket. He says the family living there had recently put a significant addition onto their home. It was a large, multi-generational family that lived in the house, which Loopy said was like a new building with the addition. This isn't the first time the family has lost a house to a fire. Last time, they were out of town when their house burned down, Loopy says.
It was not just the family, but the whole community was traumatized because it was practically new building. And family lost a lot of belongings and some of them sentimental, I guess.
Tuntutuliak Tribal Administrator Abe Andrew was in the village's monthly council meeting when the fire broke out. The council abruptly ended the meeting so community leaders could help fight the fire. Tuntutuliak doesn't currently have an organized volunteer fire department. Abe brought the village's only available water pump with him. He says dozens of people, possibly around 100, came out to help. They pumped water out of a pond about 100 feet away and used a bucket brigade to throw water onto the burning house. Carl Andrew, the power plant manager, says the fire showed the need for more firefighting equipment in Tuntutuliak.
When this thing happens, it affects the whole community. Knowing these people, they lost almost everything.
Carl Andrew says the community used to have a van outfitted with firefighting equipment. That vehicle was destroyed several years ago, in a fire, when the workshop where it was stored burned down. Tribal Administrator Abe Andrew says this time around, some of Tuntutuliak's equipment wasn't ready when the fire started. That includes another pump that didn't have fuel. Abe says next time a fire breaks out, that equipment will be ready to go. He says the community is more prepared for fires than it used to be. He says they have more equipment now than they've had for past house fires. He says the community will likely pool resources to help the family. Details on how people outside Tuntutuliak can help are still being worked out. In Bethel, I'm Nina Kravinsky.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 45 years of Alaska operations. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
The state is reopening its Steese Highway maintenance station at Central. Caitlin Williams with the Department of Transportation's Northern Region says the station closed in 2016 due to budget cuts. It's the last of five stations to reopen. Williams says having the Central station operational again will speed response time, especially important where the highway passes over Eagle Summit.
You know, that's over 3,600 feet in elevation, so really does often experience strong winds and snow drifting during the winter.
Williams says the DOT is spending $1.8 million to bring the mothballed facility back online. That includes restoring power and water as well as stocking it with equipment, fuel, gravel, and other supplies. Meanwhile, Williams says the state is hiring staff for the station and others. Students at a public charter elementary school in Ketchikan celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day with their first all-school assembly in more than 2 years. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the Tongass School of Arts and Sciences Assembly is part of the school district's efforts to promote what's known as place-based learning.
Signaitla. Good day, Thunderbirds.
Clint Schultz, a third and fourth grade teacher whose Haida name is White Wolf, welcomes students and leads them in a review of some words and phrases in the endangered Haida language, Haadkil.
Hawa. Can anyone tell me by a raise of hand, what does hawa mean? It means thank you. Can we give him a quick little applause? Excellent. All right. Ready for this one? Hausen Dunks Kingson. And what does Hausen Dunks Kingson mean? Excellent. So it means I will see you again. So can we give her a round?
After some practice, it's time to celebrate Southeast Alaska Native culture in another way with a song. Then it's time for the highlight of the afternoon, the dances. Schultz leads the children through three main moves, starting with the Raven Dance.
And we're going to get really low. Now, what a raven does is a raven hops around like this. Okay? And as it does, it looks. So we hop around. And we hop. Okay? The last one is the wolf dance. And this is kind of the strong dance. And we're going to stay really low, and our hands are going to come out in front of us like this. So one hand comes in front, the other comes below, behind.
Staying as low to the ground as possible, the students hop around the gym as Tori Schultz leads in drumming and singing. Then it's time for the women's dance. Students put their hands on their hips and glide around the room to what Schultz calls the women's competition song. Clint Schultz says the school's curriculum is designed to tie students' lessons to their community. It's what's called place-based learning.
We want the kids that are Alaska Native, who are Haida, Tlingit, and Tsimshian, to be proud of their heritage, and then we want the other students to be able to share in that. And cultural importance at the school level of all cultures is extremely important for all the kids.
It's a strategy the district hopes will keep students connected, both to their school and to their community. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Canneries are a big part of Alaska's history. Throughout the 20th century, waves of immigrants, primarily from the Philippines, came to work alongside Alaska Native people in the canneries. The mug-up exhibit at the Alaska State Museum in Juneau highlighted this history for the last 6 months. KTOO's Yvonne Crumery walked through with the curator and a former cannery worker and historian during Filipino-American History Month.
Three meals and then these mug-up breaks.
Yes.
The exhibit features lots of historic films and photos. There are black and white posed photos from the turn of the 20th century and more candid photos taken by friends from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Some panels explore the histories of the different labor movements that swept through Alaska's canneries. There's even a recreation of a bunkhouse with a door covered in the names of the workers who slept there from the 1980s until 2009. And next to it is a mess hall with a hand-painted table and a handwritten weekend menu. Jackie Manning is the exhibit's curator. Her favorite thing is a little cart used to serve coffee to workers during what was called mug-up time. And that's where the exhibit gets its name.
When I went up to Bristol Bay and I saw that little Cushman cart is what it's called, and heard the stories about how diverse the cannery crew was and how important that mug-up time was for camaraderie and everybody meeting and taking their breaks and just all the different languages you'd hear on the docks.
Oscar Peñaranda moved from the Philippines to Canada and eventually to California before coming to Alaska to work in a Bristol Bay cannery in the 1960s.
Well, sometimes to start anew, they come here. You know? And other people also are running away from things. Some have a specific destination to come. So there are many, many different reasons. But they always came back.
And he kept coming back. He worked 15 summer seasons in Alaska before deciding to stay in San Francisco full time. He's a historian now. He founded the San Francisco chapter of the Filipino American National Historical Society and wrote about his experiences as an Alaskero. That's the term for Filipinos who worked in Alaska's canneries. For Filipino American History Month, he was in Juneau last week for the closing of the exhibit. He recognized some names and faces in the exhibit, like the Filipino union leaders who formed the Alaska Cannery Workers Association. They were murdered in 1981, and he said that's when he stopped going to work in Alaska.
You don't get hired if you don't know anybody. You know, that's the two who were assassinated, that's what they were trying to clean up.
Peñaranda worked at the cannery for 14 years, and he said he kept going back for the camaraderie. He made lifelong friends.
We didn't feel like we had to get in touch between seasons because we were going to go the next season and catch up. That's part of the reason why we kept going.
The labor movements happening in the canneries paralleled his life in San Francisco in the winters. In 1968, he participated in strikes at San Francisco State that led to the forming of the school's College of Ethnic Studies. Peñaranda went on to teach literature and Filipino languages in high schools and colleges in California. He's now 78 years old, and he's thinking of returning to Bristol Bay next summer to work with an old friend. It will be the first time he will have worked at a cannery since he stopped over 40 years ago. And another reason that Peñaranda said he kept going back to cannery work was the chance to be a new version of himself.
You can reinvent yourself when you go to any work in the canneries. When you go to Alaska, you can reinvent yourself. You'll be a completely different. You don't like the way you are in San Francisco? Come to Alaska. Make your own reputation.
So, a different Oscar Peñaranda may return next summer. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Nina Kravinsky in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Shea and Yvonne Crumery in Juneau, and Eric Stone in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.